On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we recap the weekend. Two of baseball's biggest rivalries, Red Sox, Yankees, Padres, Dodgers, took the field this weekend. We recap those series and talk about three sweeps, the Cubs, the Rangers, the Pirates going undefeated. We give them some love. Talk about Kyle Raleigh, who can't stop homering. A few other notable series from the weekend. And so much more on this episode of Baseball Barbacast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that thinks Anthony Volpe should go by Anthony Volpe. I'm Jake Mintz, that's Jordan Schusterman, and that's the only way to drop the E's.
Hey, at this point, I think you should try anything to avoid lowering that fielding percentage any further. Good morning, Jake. It is nice to see you. It is Monday, August 25th. And boy, do we have a lot of baseball to talk about, so let's not delay it any further. Let's get to our opener.
The Boston Red Sox headed down to the Bronx this weekend and said, "We live here now," taking three out of four from their rival New York Yankees, winning on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, setting up a mop opportunity. It would have been the first mop for the Red Sox in a Yankee stadium since 1939, but the Yankees kept that at bay on Sunday Night Baseball, beating the Red Sox in the closer. But all in all, it was an ugly, unfortunate weekend for the Yankees. They lose in a slot fest. We talked about this one on Friday's show, 6-3 on Thursday. 1-0 nail biter on Friday night. The only run comes on a Connor Wong RBI double. I believe that's his third or fourth RBI of the year. Jordan, please check that. Game three was the Trevor Story game with the Red Sox winning 12-1. They explode for a whole bunch of runs in the top of the ninth. There's another bizarre Anthony Volpe error. Garrett Crochet looks incredible, striking out 11. Only blemish is Stanton home run. And then in game four, with the mop on the line, Dustin May, the reddest sock, cannot get the job done. Jazz homers twice. Grisham homers twice. Rodon does enough to give the Yankees a win. Takeaways from this series, Jordan Schuster.
Sixth RBI for Connor Wong on the season, which is pretty amazing considering how long he's been. I guess this is only his 49th game, but still, that is not a lot of runs driven in. But he gave them one when they needed it on Friday. And yes, this series is really the ultimate test of how good can you take a Sunday victory. I mean, this is just the nature of the sport and kind of the fan experience with weekends. I've seen many a meme about this, like what is the ideal format of a series victory here? And I'm sure the Red Sox are still feeling good having embarrassed the Yankees in three out of these four games. But that Sunday just gives you that almost false sense of hope if you're a Yankees fan when you do it on Sunday Night Baseball and there's more people watching and you defend. You said, no, we're not getting mopped today. Okay, the Yankees really stood up for themselves. But honestly, in this case, I'm not even really seeing that much optimism. And I think this a lengthy spiral down to still a postseason spot, because again, the Yankees are generally taking care of business against bad teams. Their record against their fellow playoff teams this year is troublingly poor. They did snap this 8-game losing streak against the Red Sox on Sunday. But that is why, even as we look ahead at an easy schedule the rest of the way for the Yankees, and it's hard to imagine them missing the postseason, why would we believe for one second that this is a team that is a threat to go on a serious run in October? There is just so many things that are not working well for them. Even though you see the flashes of the talent in a game like Sunday, the Yankees just have so much to prove against teams that are actually their competition this time of year.
They are currently 12-20 against the five other teams currently in playoff position in the American League. Their record against teams over 500 is fittingly 500, 34-34. and not to just be like, oh, vibes. Like, this team does not intimidate or scare you right now as currently constructed. That being said, I'm a little bit more optimistic about the Yankees just because the offense is still generally really good. Like, this is over the course of the full season, this is arguably the best offense in the league, right? And I think that if you enter the playoffs with the best offense in the league, you have a decent chance. Now, everything else does not inspire confidence. And not to sound like Aaron Boone, I just think that they have one more rise in them, like one more way, like 2 good weeks that's going to make everyone believe again. I do think that that is coming. The biggest concerns I have with this team is currently constructed. Austin Wells, I know he has given a lot of playing time away to Ben Rice, who has been catching more and more. But Anthony Volpe, my second concern, his struggles have kind of shielded Austin Wells a little bit from what has been an incredibly disappointing season.
Yeah, no, I think that that's fair. And we kind of, I think, highlighted Austin Wells coming into the year as someone that we were optimistic about, as someone that was going to take a step forward, as clearly the catcher for the Yankees that could hit 25 homers and was clearly developing really quickly as a defender. And he's got a 260 on base, and that's not good enough. Now, it's much easier to accept when you do have other great hitters, including the best hitter. But right now, and especially with Judge still kind of coming back, we're dealing with a roster where they can't have all their best hitters in the lineup. And so that is applied to Stanton. That is now applied to Judge. That is now applied to Ben Rice when they haven't been able to get him in the lineup. And I guess, honestly, in some cases, it's applied to Trent Grisham, hilariously. So they just have this weird collection of hitters where, yes, on the right day, it's like, oh, man, who's slowing these guys down? But it is requiring, especially with this latest wrinkle of Judge's injury, this level of configuration that is not always super comfortable. Now, again, they're still putting up a bunch of runs. And if Stanton is able to even play a few times a week, your lineup's going to look pretty good. But this Judge thing is a massive deal, and it seems massive. Like he has started throwing. He has thrown in public, which is something. We can take something from that.
When's the last time you did that?
Threw in front of that many people. Yeah, that I don't know. This has been a long time. I have thrown a baseball not that long ago, but with that many people watching intently. Now, that said, the Yankees, as they always do with anything injury related, and no surprise that it is happening with the most important player, are not being super clear about when Aaron Judge will be back in the outfield again. But I mean, the fact that we are seeing him throw gives me some amount of confidence that this is something that is going to happen, because until that happened, I had no reason to believe we were definitely going to see him back in the outfield again, truly. For all the optimism that he had expressed, now I think that that will come and that will open some things up. But the key is, because so many parts of their team are just shakier, it is going to be important for them to have this juggernaut offense, this juggernaut lineup. And that is one that includes Stanton. And that is one that probably includes Rice. And of course, one that includes Judge in the outfield.
Is there an argument to putting Judge in right and DHing Stanton and just not having Judge throw? Like, how many times a game do you need to make a competitive throw to a base as an outfielder on average? One? Now, I understand those come in big spots, and maybe late in the game you do some defensive rearranging. But, like, ball hit down the right field line. Trent Grisham, just, you're in center. Sprint. Get over there. Judge underhand
there
flips
was
it.
There's some precedent. Didn't this happen with Ozuna at some point?
Maybe. This just feels like the most extreme example. Like, having Stanton and Judge both in the lineup, like, the added value of Stanton 4 at-bats versus the other team getting 1 or 2 extra bases a game.
Well, that's the question, right? It is an interesting math problem that maybe they're doing, but I have to imagine Aaron Judge is not going to go out there until he feels like he can, or until they feel like he feels like he can make a play in a big spot because the optics there are still a lot worse. And I don't think the Yankees are like willing to try something that ridiculous, to be honest.
No, I understand. I think that there is a team that would. Because like the downside from a PR highlight perspective is enormous. If you have Judge like flipping a ball to Grisham and then he overthrew, like it could be disastrous. I understand that. But I think a weirder team would try it. I really do.
Hmm. Yeah. I mean, the problem is this Judge, there's just so much more at stake in terms of re-injury and whatnot that like they're weighing more than just individual stuff. But all that said, let's not give the Yankees too much credit here because they did lose 3 out of 4 here, and we'll flip it to the Red Sox. But I am with you on, but the problem is, and Yankees fans themselves are saying this, like they're going to get fooled if they go and, you know, kick the crap out of the White Sox and Twins and Orioles and whoever else, all the other bad teams they have left to play at the end of September. Now they still have a tough schedule coming up before they get to that really easy slate at the end of the month. And so if they stumble here, I know they have Nats and White Sox coming up to finish August. Then it goes Astros, Blue Jays, Tigers, Red Sox. So like that little run there is where we're going to really find out about them. But the problem is there's just nobody pushing them to really make them sweat in the American League wildcard race, except for, in this case, the Red Sox, who are in position to at least secure home field, right? I mean, this is really what the Yankees are probably playing for, even if they are going to be able to get into the postseason just by beating bad teams. The Red Sox have shown us, I think, a version of them that we can start to get excited about. While there were moments for the Yankees that looked more encouraging, what Fried did was really, really good to see for how much he's been struggling recently. The best version of the Red Sox, when you have Crochet going, and when you have Bayo throwing well, you know, obviously Giolito has been mostly good recently. It's a pretty good looking ball club, I would say, especially with Trevor Story. What Trevor Story has kind of turned into recently is really impressive. I would say the fact that he's no longer just a total nothing is really impressive. Again, there's still parts of that roster that I don't totally believe in either. But they looked like the better overall team this weekend, and that was not really particularly close. Like, Dustin May is not going to be starting a postseason game. So
no.
It looked really bad last night, and I don't think that's ever going to be, you know, plan A in a game that they absolutely need to win.
As currently set, it would be Mariners, Astros in Houston, and Yankees, Red Sox in Boston for the AL wildcard series.
Stop the count. Let's do it. Let's just roll it out there. I mean, I don't know how much either, you know, the Mariners or the Yankees want that, but I think the neutral would certainly be enjoying that.
Now, before we move on, I do want to just hop back to Volpe for a second, because I just think that what's going on with him is so interesting. Every year, it feels like the Yankees fans pick a player to just emotionally eviscerate. We have seen this with Joey Gallo and Aaron Hicks and IKF and last year Trent Grisham, but he beat it. Okay. He fought back. He raged against it. It kind of happened with Josh Donaldson and DJ LeMahieu, but they were so hurt and bad. They weren't like breaking down a quality player, if that makes sense. That main character this year is Volpe. Now, he has invited a lot of the scorn and the criticism on himself, and we have now entered this very depressing death spiral where he just makes an error, people yell at him. 2 days later, he's clearly moving with the weight of those expectations. He makes another error, and it just compounds upon itself. Now, he puts some of those jeers, those boos, those concerns to rest after the All-Star break. Like, he was cooking in the 2 weeks after the All-Star break with a 10.35 OPS and 7 home runs in his first 14 games after. Since then, he had a 4-hit day on August 1st. Since then, Anthony Volpe is 8-for-66 with 1 home run. That is a 121, 171, 242 batting line. He leads Major League Baseball in errors. And last night was effectively benched for Jose Caballero, shortstop on Sunday Night Baseball. And I think Volpe is just such an interesting character here. And I think that, let's just tell the whole thing, right? Like, in camp in 2023, he makes the team when he's not expected to. And though he appeared relatively ready with his performance, he was good defensively that year. He hit 21 homers, stole 24 bags as a 22-year-old. The overall offensive line was not good. He wins a gold glove. Last year, he shows a couple, like the defense gets even better. He shows a little bit more life with the bat. And now it's like, all right, he's 24. Let's go. It's time to prove it. And he has simply not done that. And I think that it all starts back in 2023, because when he shows up, Jordan, you'll have a better sense of this than I do. The reputation versus the actual prospect pedigree was pretty large. And this does happen with Yankees prospects sometimes, but people were expecting this guy to be an impact hitter, where maybe that was never going to be the case. Can you kind of shed a little bit more light on that?
I mean, yes, I agree with what you're getting at, because the scouting did not suggest, like, oh my God, he is about to be this, you know, 30-30 game-changing offensive talent. But his minor league stats were outrageous. I mean, he, like, and that lent enough, you know, hype to where it was like, maybe he can be that. And the irony, of course, is that he kind of was doing it. He goes 2020 as a rookie. But so much of else besides those counting stats have been so bad and have effectively gotten worse that he's had enough of these slumps to where, as people have pointed out, among hitters that have played as much as Anthony Volpe over the last 3 years, he has essentially been the worst hitter in baseball, or close to it. If you go by park adjusted numbers over a large sample, now part of that is that most hitters like that are not playing that often. That's what comes with being a gold glove shortstop, or at least what he was before. The defense, by all accounts, has backed up this year, and now you have a player that is no longer contributing meaningfully on either side of the ball. But because he had that track record, that is where you get the very staunch defense from Aaron Boone over and over and over and over.
I don't think I want to push back against the defense backing up. Like, it's way worse. Like, don't get me wrong, the defense is bad, right? But the numbers are bad because he's messing up easy plays, not like because he's gotten slower or worse at the other stuff. Like, if you know, he's leading the league in errors. If you go through defensive metrics, how good you are at making the easiest plays as a bigger impact. Now, obviously, that's part of it. I'm not just like waving that away, but the player is still in here. I really do believe that an MVP candidate is not in here, and maybe not even an all-star is in here, but like, he's still only 24, man. He's still only 24. Like, there are prospects that are younger, or excuse me, that are older than Anthony Volpe still. And okay, so here's a very random way to think about it. If Anthony Volpe was a prospect, where would he rank, right? I know that's kind of a silly way to consider it.
No, but this is what's hard, because this is why the sample of 1,500 plate appearances,
it's a lot,
being one of the worst hitters is hard to swallow, because that's where it's harder to be like, oh, he's young. Oh, he's only 24. Oh, he's still. It's like, well, not that players cannot get better later in their career. This happens. It's just baseball, of course. But it's harder when you have that much of a sample size of a 280 on base. And it's just like, okay, this is going to require some serious changes. I also think narrative-wise, the biggest difference between, and I know you've brought this up a million times, but all those other guys were outsiders, right? All those other guys were brought in because the front office thought they would fit, and they either did for a little bit and then didn't, or they didn't immediately, or it was just like, Anthony Volpe's the opposite of that. Anthony Volpe, for all the reasons that we understand, was supposed to be this next guy, not just because he was a first-round pick and was having these awesome minor league numbers, but because he was the guy from New Jersey who was a Yankees fan and wanted to be Derek Jeter and all these things. And so now he's holding expectations that come both on and off the field that clearly were probably unfair to begin with. But it's been a perfect storm, because you have had the organization defending him far beyond what you would probably expect for a player that's performing this poorly for this long. Does that mean that they should DFA him? No, but it does put them in an interesting spot. I mean, the other part that I think is like, is this outsized? One, is it this important? Yes, because he's the shortstop. Is it this important because he's still batting seventh, eighth, or ninth? Should I care that much that he has a 280 on base if he can make the routine play? Probably not, but when you're the shortstop of the Yankees, that's just part of it.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Defense, I don't really know where this goes from here. I don't know.
The defense is the thing, because you can swallow the rest of it if he's making plays at short. And he's just simply not doing that this year. And it's just so bad. Just for some context, I know you make a great point about the sample size. I mean, he's essentially a month older than Spencer Jones, right? He is 4 months older than Alex Freeland, who just got called up by the Dodgers. Mm-hmm. And I just think that there is more time here for Anthony Volpe to become something. Does the runway exist in New York? Like, if you're the Yankees and Trevor Story opts out, like, you have to think about that. You have to. Mm. I think that entering camp next year, and I think this is the most substantial change, entering camp next year, the job should not automatically belong to Anthony Volpe, right? I think that is what should change. All right, let's move on from Yankees Red Sox and do another rivalry, because the Pods played the Dodds over the weekend in Southern California, baseball's real number one rivalry. Padres taking games 1 and 2 before the Dodgers storm back with a late burst on Sunday. First game was a delight. Padres taking that 2-1. Bogaerts sack fly. The difference. Snell looked really good. San Diego bullpen looked really good. Game 2, Ramon Laureano, 2 RBI single in the 4th. There's a big Bogaerts double late. Nestor Cortez, 6 scoreless in an all-time revenge game. There was one moment in this game that was just so funny where he threw a fastball like up and into Freddie Freeman, but he got it up and in enough to get Freeman to fly out to center. And it was like, man.
Oh, that's what he was trying to do.
Oh, that's what it is.
Wasn't Nestor was like perfect through 5 in this one. I mean, he was dicing him up.
Yeah, he was really he was locked in for this. Game 3, big Elias Diaz homer. Looks like the Padres are going to sweep because San Diego had used all of its A arms in the first two games, which were close. They kind of go to the second level relievers. Dodgers jump on that. Best moment of Dalton Rushing's career thus far with a huge go-ahead 3-run blast late in that one. Freddie hits a homer. Otani hits a homer. The Dodgers salvage the finale 8-2. And these two teams now entering this next week are tied atop the NL West with identical records.
31 games to go. I loved that Mike Schilt was asked after this game on Sunday. All right, Mike, if I told you in spring training, man, like you're going to be tied 31 games to go, you know, what would you take? What would you think? And Mike Schilt said, sounds about right. So Schilt? This is, of course, what Schilt was envisioning all along. And, you know, whether the Dodgers would admit we thought we'd be 20 games up or whether they'd be like, yeah, of course, the Padres are playing us close. I think we've seen mixed messaging from that, from the Dodgers, levels of confidence being like, yeah, we're not worried about them, to like, yeah, they're really good. We understand that they're really good. But like, catch us in October because that's when it matters. So we'll see. But I do love that. Obviously, if the Padres were able to sweep after the Dodgers swept them last week, that would have felt a little bit better from a narrative standpoint. The Dodgers do already have the tiebreaker clinched, which is also important. Remember, folks, these are things that matter. But I believe that was basically already true even coming into this weekend. So if they do finish tied, sorry, sucks to suck. But this was still a good showing from San Diego. Obviously, they've been much better at home. Disappointing way to go on Sunday. And, you know, we mentioned the second level Padres bullpen. That's still a really good pitchers. And Jeremiah Estrada, when he hasn't been facing the Dodgers this year, has been outstanding, you know, and even Wandy Peralta and Yuki Matsui, like those are good pitchers. But the Dodgers offense finally really woke up there. It was nice to see Yamamoto kind of lock back in after kind of losing it early in that one. And Dodgers finally getting a little bit healthier in the bullpen. That's a huge deal for them, getting Tanner Scott back, getting Kirby Yates back. Obviously, the rotation at this point is pretty much healthy, right? Besides Roki, who we've mentioned we're not counting much on at all moving forward. But how good Snell's looked. We've seen Glass now. We've seen, of course, Kershaw, Otani pitching more and more. So we're starting to see these teams at close to full strength. The Padres losing Jackson Merrill again to the IL is disappointing. I think it's been a really weird year for Merrill, for how well he started and then has been dealing with multiple different injuries, and he had a concussion and now dealing with an ankle. At the same time, this still felt like, yeah, nope, this is Padres Dodgers. I hope we get to see this again in the postseason. And it was a good bounce back from the Dodgers though on Sunday.
Kind of a big L. These teams don't play in September. I think that this is the casualty of the balanced schedule of teams playing teams every year, right? Everybody now plays everybody at least once a year from the AL across to the NL. And I don't care about that. I'd rather have two more Padres Dodgers sets in September, even that means like I have to watch, you know, like Pirates Cardinals an extra two times. Like I want the high end. I want more of that. Quickly on Schilt, he's such a fascinating character in this dude. Like he is like a Clint Eastwood Scrooge character from Gran Torino or whatever, where he's like, yeah, get off my lawn. I run the Padres. Like, and then the team is just the like the opposite of that.
It's like, yeah, yeah.
He's what a fascinating person to be in charge of the team. I just struggle to parse that out. I think the Dodgers are pretty well set up if the relievers stay healthy, and that is a big if. I think if the Padres win yesterday, maybe there's more concern. But all things considered, like if you ask both of these managers, when you take this at the beginning of the year, I think the answer is yes. I think Blake Snell looking as good as he did in that second game, despite the loss, he has now made six starts. He has allowed seven earned runs only over those six starts, striking out 30 in 32 innings. That's a huge deal. Here we go, Jordan. Dodgers playoff rotation. If they get to pick it and we're playing tomorrow, what's the order?
Man, I mean, that's the thing. And it's hard to know because if they're basically fighting for a bye down to the end of the season, like, are they going to be able to
forget about that? Yeah. Just line it up.
I think it's Yamamoto game one. I think it's Snell game two. I think it's Ohtani game three. I think it's Kershaw. Oh, man. Kershaw Glasnow is fascinating. Like, I know we've heard our friend and Kershaw book writer Andy McCullough talk about this on his roundtable pod. But like, truly, like, how many innings Clayton Kershaw throws in October, to what level they use him versus like a Glasnow is undeniably one of the most interesting things that we are heading towards. Now, the other problem with this is, listen, the odds of all of these guys getting even to October 1st, which isn't that far away healthy, is just, as history tells us, that that's not going to happen. But I don't know. Well, how would you shake? I mean, Yamamoto and Snell, I feel like, are pretty clearly 1-2. And
I would throw Snell game Ohtani's two just start. To break up the righties.
Yes. And I don't think Ohtani's going to be in the bullpen. I think he's either going to start or he's not going to start. So, and I think Ohtani is going to start. Glasnow is the one where it's like, I don't know, man.
Hey,
he has, I mean, he's been fine. It's not like he's looked awful, but for how much better Snell has looked, you know, you're thinking more about him. You're more excited to give him the ball.
So, no, all right.
That is a weird one.
Enough pods, Dodgers. Anything else quickly?
I just have one more Dodgers thing. Like I mentioned that they're starting to look back to full strength. They still don't have, you know, Muncy hurt again. Tommy Edman's still injured. Kike still out. Haesung Kim still out. You know, the bottom of this offensive group is still like the fact that Buddy Kennedy, bless his heart, you know, Millville's own, like how in the world he's getting plate appearances for this team, let alone Justin Dean and, you know, Conforto is troubling. All that said, that's why seeing big swings from Freeland and Rushing, who are very talented huge. Young players who have could be huge parts of the Dodgers' future, right? I mean, if there is a concern about the Dodgers being the best team in baseball forever, it's that a lot of these guys are, I mean, they're one of the oldest teams in baseball. And so if they can start to get consistent contributions, even if it's in a bench capacity from Freeland, from Rushing, and especially when they're starting, that is a huge deal, not just for this year, but as we project forward as to what the Dodgers are going to look like for years to come. Because those are two guys that obviously through all the trades, they've held on to them. And I think that it has to be really encouraging, especially while guys like Muncy and Edman are still out. And then just a reminder, you know, as you mentioned, they're not playing again this season, but the Dodgers still have seven more against the Giants in position to play spoiler. And the Padres have the easiest schedule left in Major League Baseball. Seven more against the Rockies for the Padres. And right, we said, okay, how many of those games are you going to win? The Dodgers split two games with the Rockies last week. That's a huge deal. You know, and if the Padres can win all seven against Colorado, which I doubt they will because it's just baseball, it's weird. That could be the difference in the division. And they also have games against the White Sox and the Twins, who, holy crap, the Twins. So, hashtag rock bottom, they are embracing. So anyway, the schedule could play a role. I agree, it is a little bit disappointing they won't play again. But this is definitely the rivalry we want to see again. Let's take a break, Jake. And we did have some sweeps. We didn't lead with it because they weren't quite as spicy. But we will talk about them when we return on Baseball Barbacast. Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. We had three sweeps over the weekend. Let's get into it. How sweep it is.
Clean up, everybody.
There is no shame in getting swept.
I never got swept.
You guys got swept.
Kyle Tucker says, call an ambulance. But not for me. He homers. Game one against the Angels on Friday, twice more against the Angels on Saturday, reaches base three more times in game three on Sunday as the Chicago Cubbies sweep the Angels of Los Angeles in Anaheim, take all three games. They have now won eight of their last 10, and I don't think this could have been a more invigorating weekend on the north side.
Yeah, this was, again, it's been kind of a stressful stretch. So much Brewers love, including here on this podcast.
Yep.
Shout out Brian Anderson. That was still, what a delight. Well, that was a good time. But the Cubs had a nice little weekend here. And we'll get to the Brewers later as they dropped a series. But this is what you got to do. If you have an offense that the Cubs purport to have and you go and face a team with the pitching staff that the Angels do, let's put up some runs, baby. And that's what they did, especially in that Saturday game, winning 12-1. Love to see PCA getting a big swing off against Kenley Jansen in the ninth inning on Friday. That was very encouraging. Cade Horton continues to be extremely impressive and probably one of the more important pitchers just in the general playoff universe is Cade Horton and what the Cubs are going to expect out of him, especially as his innings workload continues to climb and climb and climb. Daniel Palencia, who's just been an awesome kind of revelation in the bullpen for Chicago, always thrown hard, but it's like, can you trust this guy in high leverage? He notches his 20th save on Sunday. I remember writing about Daniel Palencia in spring after he was throwing 101 miles an hour in like the first spring training game of the year. And I was like, let's not forget about this guy, because if he just slightly figures it out a little bit more, he will be closing games. That is exactly what has happened for him. And now the Cubs have a two-game cushion in the top NL wildcard spot. Still five games back from Milwaukee, so, you know, going to be tough to make that up. But, you know, this is the version of the Cubs that we started to get excited about, the version of the Cubs that we picked to win the division. And if you can get good enough pitching from guys like Taillon and Horton, this offense can absolutely carry. So it's nice to see them take care of business on the road against a team in the Angels that is not very good. And so, yeah, I mean, hey, man, credit to the Cubbies. I'm wearing my South Bend Cubs hat today for a reason. They got me feeling good.
They also have a pretty easy schedule left, second easiest only behind San Diego. They've got three against the Mets and four against the Reds. And besides that, Rockies, Nats, Pirates, six against Atlanta, who I understand is playing better, Giants and Rays. And so there's room here for the Cubs to make this interesting with Milwaukee. That would be very fun if that race kind of compressed back into something more compelling. Our other sweeps, let's do Rangers over Guardians. Jordan, you and I used to work at summer camp together. And something I remember vividly is that our boss who ran that camp, when he was mad at one of us, he would always say, step into my office. Do you remember that?
Which, again, you should give people context.
Yeah.
There was no office. We were outside for 8 hours. This was not an actual office to step into. But yes, it did carry weight, though, even though there was no physical space.
Step into my proverbial office. And that's what I would like to do with the Guardians. The Guardians are being called to the principal's office. I am taking them out of class, and I am informing them that their recent behavior is simply not acceptable. We don't do that around here. As they get whooped by the Rangers in Texas over the weekend, big go-ahead hit by Jose Ramirez on Friday night. That doesn't matter because Cade Smith blows it on a chalk walk-off. Rangers win 4-3. Game two, best start of Jack Leiter's short career. Two hits, no runs over seven with 10 punch outs as the Rangers win 10-0. Game three, Gavin Williams is bad. Merrill Kelly goes 7 scoreless. Rowdy hits his 15th home run. How about that? And the Rangers win in another shutout. And like, I just want this AL wildcard race to mean something. And it's probably not going to. Now, the Rangers have jumped the Gardos. With this sweep, they are now 4.5 back in Texas. Cleveland is now 5 back. Just the optimism sucked out of the air in Cleveland, man. I know you're around this team a lot, but this is just disappointing. You know what? I'm mad and disappointed.
Yeah, but I do think that this was a nice moment of like, okay, we've been staring at these two teams close in the standings for the last 2 months. One of these teams has a very impressive run differential. One of them does not. Let's see what happens when they play 3 games and we find out. And now here we are with the Rangers, again, only a half game up on the Guardians with a plus. This is absurd. The Rangers have a plus 63 run differential, Cleveland minus 50. Okay, think about that gap, even though it's a half game of the standings. But that is where that is why we care about that. That's because when you go into a series like this, you are probably picking Texas because they have performed like the better baseball team, even if the record does not necessarily indicate it. And at the very least, I feel like we learned that for sure. As for Cleveland, they can't get out of their own way. They are too competent and have enough good players and enough good infrastructure to not let the bottom completely fall out. Now, you saw them lose 10 in a row, which was very uncharacteristic earlier this season, but then you saw them bounce back and get back to 500 or whatnot. At the same time, again, minus 50 run differential. Do I expect them to finish 15 games under? No, but that's why at no point was I like, this is a playoff team. And I'd love for them to prove me wrong because I'd love to have postseason baseball in my backyard again. But this was the 8th time they were swept this year, which is tied with the Pirates for the 3rd most behind the White Sox and Rockies. So they have been susceptible to just looking really bad over these short little stretches, and obviously good enough to not have a terrible record, but that's why they are where they are. As for Texas, what a weird season. Like I said, still don't expect them to really make it too interesting here. But the fact that Jacob DeGrom is essentially the only player on their team that's staying healthy the whole year is some sort of cruel joke. I mean, I've enjoyed watching Jacob DeGrom, but now they lose Marcus Semien likely for the rest of the year as he has a broken toe. But yeah, Sean McFarland, one of their beats, a good friend of the show, he tweeted a picture of like basically all the key players in the Rangers outside the stadium. And yeah, I mean, like as he points out, Jacob DeGrom's the only one that hasn't been on the injured list. Marcus Semien, the consummate, you know, Iron Man of his era, him going down now is just another example of that Rangers injury luck. So maybe they make it interesting. I don't know. Again, the run differential tells me they're a pretty good team. That's another team that's been so much better at home than on the road. So they're going to have to show something on the road in September if they're going to make this remotely competitive. At the same time, I do think as we try and figure out who is that next best team, them versus Kansas City is an interesting discussion. Kansas City just took 3 out of 4 against Texas last week. So we kind of assume the Royals are better, but I don't know. Rangers absolutely up there for one of the weirdest seasons. And let me just say, last thing on them, Rowdy Tellez, 15th homer of the season. He's been great for them. Let me just remind people of my bold prediction. Before the year, we'll obviously revisit all the bold predictions at the end of the season, but this is one I am tracking quite closely. Now, this was a Mariners bold prediction, but it was, you know, about Rowdy Tellez. I said that he was going to hit more home runs than anyone on the Pirates after getting booed in Pittsburgh last year. He's got 15. O'Neill Cruz leads the Pirates with 18 and is still on the injured list. So if Rowdy can stay hot in September, I got a shot here. We'll see.
The thing about Cleveland is that it's really straightforward, man. They just don't have enough good hitters. Like, they have the third worst offense in baseball. It's just...
Yep. That's sure what it's looked like, let me
tell you. And Jose Ramirez. And Jose Ramirez. You know how hard it is to have the third worst offense in baseball and Jose Ramirez? It's not that complicated. Go get better hitters, man. Go get better hitters.
Yep. Speaking of go get better hitters, the Pirates didn't need too many good hitters this weekend as they sweep the Rockies. Oh, my goodness. The Pirates have good pitchers. The Rockies are a bad baseball team, and that's what this weekend was. We had the Bubba Chandler Major League debut on Friday in relief, which was strange, but he seemed to enjoy it. Four innings save. Pirates win 9-0. They win 5-1 on Saturday. Mike Burrows was very good. And then Paul Skeens on Roku Sunday leadoff with Jen Powell back behind the dish. Jen making her second appearance. Of course, making history recently as the first woman to umpire a major league game behind home plate. She was behind the dish and have not seen her scorecard yet, but I felt like she was pretty locked in. I was watching every pitch of this game. And my takeaway from this one was Paul Skeens was like, this was like a C-plus Paul Skeens performance. His command was not there. And I'm saying that knowing he walked zero batters. But he was not in the zone early in counts. He was constantly behind. And it just didn't matter because the Rockies do not have good enough hitters to deal with Paul Skeens. Most teams do not have good enough hitters to deal with Paul Skeens as he goes 7 scoreless. 2.02 ERA through his first 50 starts is the second lowest in the live ball era behind only Vita Blue, who was 2.01. The Rockies swept for a 16th time. The Pirates improving to 39-30 at home, which is incredible because they are 18-44 on the road. And with how Ashcraft looked before Bubba, how Burrows looked, how Bubba looked, how Skeens looked, listen, man, the Pirates can chuck it. And if they can ever cobble together even an average offense, maybe we will be able to take them seriously.
This was their 16th shutout of the season on Sunday. 15th on Saturday, 16th on Sunday, which puts them into the lead in Major League Baseball. Yes, that is right. No team in baseball this year has chucked more shutouts than the frickin' Pittsburgh Pirates. They have, this is so good, dude. 28% of their wins this year have been shutout wins. 28% of their wins. Also, like the Guardians, not enough good hitters. It's not that complicated.
No.
The Pirates' pitching infrastructure is unequivocally good and impressive, and they deserve credit for that. At the same time, it makes the rest of the operation even more frustrating when it's like, you did this thing that's hard to do. You have these good players doing the pitching.
Right. I believe this fun fact slightly changed over the weekend because Tommy Pham had a nice weekend. Jay Jaffe wrote about this at Fangraphs last week. Unbelievable thing to monitor with the Pirates. They were on pace, and I guess still are, if Tommy Pham, you know, goes 0 for 10 at some point, to be the only team in baseball history to have zero hitters with a 100 WRC plus or higher of any amount of playing time. Okay, so think about that. Not a single hitter above average. And anyone, guys with 5 at-bats, nobody. Like, that is so hard to do. The White Sox last year came pretty close to doing this. But man, oh man. So we'll see if that actually ends up holding. But that is what they're dealing with. That is where they are at. But as you mentioned, they are quite good. Same number of shutouts this weekend against the Rockies as the Rockies have had all season. The Rockies officially eliminated from playoff contention. They are 37-94. Yeah, I know. I'm sorry to break that news to you here.
They're what?
The pod. Jake is in shambles. Yeah, they're out.
No, their record is...
37-94.
And now they're eliminated at their 94th loss. Yeah.
Yep, 94th loss. Now, again, they're still on pace to do better than last year's White Sox, but if they keep playing like they did this weekend, I'm starting to get a little bit worried. Anyway, Paul Skeens is amazing. Paul Skeens, we're going to talk about Zach Wheeler here in a little bit. Of course, incredibly unfortunate circumstances that we are not going to have Skeens versus Wheeler down the stretch. Christopher Sanchez is going to make it interesting. But Paul Skeens is going to...
He's not.
He's, yeah, no, no.
He's not going to make it interesting.
He's going to do his part, but so is Paul Skeens, so like, it doesn't really matter.
The only way that Christopher Sanchez wins the NL Cy Young is if Paul Skeens is bad, right? In a weird way, like Christopher Sanchez would have to go full Jake Arrieta 2016, right? This is Paul Skeens' Cy Young to lose at this point, both from a narrative perspective and from a statistical perspective. Wheeler not being in the mix is really unfortunate. Skeens said as much over the weekend, in the same way that players, when they go out there on the mound, they want to face the best. And Skeens wants to win a Cy Young against the best. He doesn't want an asterisk attached to it. That's very understandable. But we're now at a point where I would be very surprised if Skeens does not win the Cy Young.
And again, Wheeler or not, this won't be an asterisk because Paul Skeens has been unbelievable. He looks like the Cy Young. He looks like the best pitcher in the league. He's not just we're not just defaulting like, oh, I guess he wins. Like, no,
he's a 207.
He's been incredible. So, yeah, he's going to be 239 FIP. Oh my goodness. All right, Paul Skeens is amazing. All right, let's hit a few more notable series before we take a break. Let's go around the league.
Mariners taking 2 out of 3 over the A's. They win on Friday night, 3-2. Brian Wu was very good in that one. They lose game 2. The A's pen locks it down. Late knock for Shea Langeliers, and the Yolo County Athletics take that 2-1 and 10. Game 3, the M's strike back, torching Jacob Lopez. Cal Raleigh hits number 48 and 49 to pass Salvador Perez for the most home runs hit in a single season by a catcher. He already had the most home runs in a single season by a big dumper, and the accolades just keep rolling. The Mariners win that one 11-4. How many home runs does Cal Raleigh finish with, Jordan?
I mean, I feel like we guessed on here at some point, or maybe this was on some other Mariners pod.
100? I've had to keep adjusting. Too much?
I've had to keep adjusting high? Upwards, obviously. I mean, listen, this is, I tweeted this yesterday, but I do want to take a pause here on this specific record because the Salvador Perez season, the Royals were awful. So it really was just like something you would check in on occasionally when Sal Perez homered and like, it was like, who cares about the Royals? This is a little bit different because, you know, the Mariners are trying to make the postseason or whatever. And so they feel more relevant. And so it feels like we're talking about more. I just remember being in complete awe of the Salvador Perez season. I even watching his career up until that point and knowing that he was a great player, I could not fathom that this guy who was squatting this often was also hitting this many home runs. And Cal Raleigh is going to just so far destroy this record that it is laughable that the degree to which I was impressed at the time and really speaks to what the season is, which is one of the greatest individual seasons of all time, however you measure it. How many does he finish with? Because we are now looking at, now we can ask that about a few guys. A great note from Opta that this is only the third time in Major League history that three different hitters had 45 home runs before September. That, of course, is Shohei Ohtani, who hit his 45th on Sunday. That is Kyle Schwarber, who I believe is up to 46. And then now Cal Raleigh, who is at 49 home runs. And the fun thing about Cal is that he's been, you know, he is chasing all these different records. He has, okay, now most as a guy who caught 50% of his games, okay, he has that record. He is potentially has a shot at the most home runs by a switch hitter ever. Forget the position. That belongs to Mickey Mantle in 1961 with 54. And at this point, yeah, I think he's going to hit more than 54 home runs. So like that seems like a record he's probably going to do. And then you're talking about 60. You're talking about 61. You're talking about 62. You're talking about 63. And again, he kind of went in a bit of a cold spell since the break, was striking out a lot. The overall numbers were not there. But even during that stretch, when he was collecting hits, they were home runs. So like his pace for the home runs, even though the OPS was dipping a lot, was still in a good place. And I don't know, man, at this point, I don't really, it feels goofy to doubt him. I don't know. I am in shock. I can't believe that this is happening. And then it's just like where Cal Raleigh fits in historically, just as a catcher at the start of his career, you also start to have those conversations.
Good time for a little trivia here. I want you to run through the home run leaderboard, the top 10 home run hitters since the break. Who are they?
Okay.
I have those in front of me. You do not.
Yeah. So I mean, Cal, I don't think has the most, but I think he's up there. I think he's got like 11 or 12 since the break. Is that correct?
Correct. He is 11.
Okay. So he has 11. All right. So I know that I don't believe he homered this weekend, but I'm pretty sure Shea Langeliers is number one.
Shea Langeliers has 16 home runs since the All-Star break.
Yes. And I mean, dude, like, he also deserves to be talked about more. Again, you're kind of tough season to kind of be trying to break through when Cal has 49, but I'm super impressed with him. Like, I think when we see like top catchers list going into next season, he is going to deservingly be very, very, very high. Okay, so Shea Langeliers is number one. I knew that. I believe Kurtz is also up there still.
No.
Okay, really? Interesting. That is surprising, because weren't all those home runs after the break? Because I saw him and then he hit the four.
Many of them weren't. Not enough.
Okay. All right. Colson Montgomery with the White Sox, I believe, is up there.
Correct. He has 13.
Okay. I believe Ohtani is also up there.
Yeah. Good player. He also has 13.
And I'm not sure. I'm not as sure about Schwarber, but I'll guess him.
Schwarber has 15 home runs since the break. He is
okay.
Not sure why you weren't sure.
All right. Okay, so who else has climbed?
You're missing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 guys in the top 10.
You know, I was going to say Jazz or Grisham, but that's recency bias. And I don't think it's Judge. I don't think Judge is on this list.
No.
So I'm not going to guess him. All right, I will guess one more player, and I will go with Michael Harris. As a guess.
Michael Harris is wrong. He's not in the top 10. The ones he missed, Junior Caminero, 14 home runs since the break. Vinny Pasquantino,
we just talked about
again
him
over the weekend.
We'll get to
Bryce
him later,
Harper has 11. Julio Rodriguez has 11. And Giancarlo Stanton has 12. Giancarlo, who does not even qualify. Not a qualified hitter during the second half. He has not played enough to like be eligible, and yet he has cranked 12 home runs. What a freaking thing.
So anyway, but yeah, Cal, you know, Cal coming for history. Good for him. I mean, listen, man, he's tied with Judge and WAR now. It's going to be really difficult for him unless Judge has like an 0 for 15, which is probably not going to happen. I guess it could. OPS wise, he's not going to get anywhere near him. Batting average wise, stuff like that. But I'll say this. I think I'd still expect Judge to win at this stage. I don't think Judge is going to be unanimous at this point. I think
No way.
Which again, like even at this point last year, I was like, oh, I think Bobby Witt Jr. could get some votes. And he didn't. So, right, I'm pretty sure Bobby Witt Jr. did not get actually any votes. Even though, again, you could have said I wouldn't have been shocked if he did because he was a 10 WAR shortstop. But Judge was unanimous last year. At this point, I would be surprised if Judge is unanimous this year. And there are some people like, what do you mean? Of course not. Cal Raleigh's going to win. Maybe. If he does. And if Cal Raleigh beats out the Aaron Judge, you know, 1,100 OPS season, God bless him. He will have absolutely earned it. There is no doubt about that. As for Seattle, Logan Gilbert has the highest strikeout rate in baseball. Minimum 90 innings. That's ridiculous and should be noticed, I feel like. He has been much more inconsistent from a run prevention standpoint, but his stuff has been marvelous since he came back from his injury. Victor Robles is back, which is interesting. He is appealing his 10-game suspension for throwing a bat at a pitcher in a minor league game. I think that he will still have a pretty long suspension. Maybe it gets shortened somewhat. They DFA'd Dylan Moore, their longest tenured player, just because that's how the roster kind of shook out, and he has not been hitting recently. What a career for Dylan Moore with the Mariners, who signed as a minor league free agent with a major league contract in 2019, right as the rebuild was starting, right before the big Robinson Cano and Edwin Diaz trade, right before all that, right before they totally flipped the roster over. And for him to stick around on a team that was good, that has been good for the last 4 years, is really, really, really impressive. It'll be interesting to see if he catches on somewhere else for the end of the season. But Victor Robles is back. He is a better baseball player at this point, but How many games he gets suspended for is going to be interesting once that gets decided this week.
Dylan Moore, free agent this upcoming winter.
Yeah.
The yeah. that he
free agent right had now
survived this so, free agent right now.
Yeah. yeah.
and this upcoming winter, unless a team yeah. signs him and chooses to extend him for some reason. Two more series before we throw it into turbo mode. Philly's taking 2 out of 3 over the Nats. Yoan Duran blows a lead on Friday night, blows a save. There was a lot of hubbub like, oh, the Phillies TV is probably finally going to put the Duran celebration the Duran entrance on every single time. And then he immediately coughs one up, comes back the next night, notches a save. They win that 6-4. Ranger Suarez, great on Sunday. The Phillies take 2 out of 3. Big takeaway here, though. We get news. Zach Wheeler is going to be out for the rest of the season as long as 8 months, 6 to 8 months, diagnosed with TOS, thoracic outlet syndrome. Now, I think we talked about this previously on the show. There are two main types of TOS, thoracic outlet syndrome. There's one that is more concerned with the nerves and one that is more concerned with the veins, both of which sound scary, obviously. And the one that Wheeler has is the one that is related to the veins. It is most similar to a surgery that Merrill Kelly had back in 2020, one that he bounced back from eventually. It is not similar to the one that Steven Strasburg had. That is the nerve-related one, where it is probably more damning for a player to have that. And so I think while the outlook here is a huge bummer for the Phillies and for the rest of their season, this is relatively good news for Zach Wheeler, for one, his overall health and well-being, and two, his career. As far as what this means for the Phillies in the playoffs, I think it's pretty straightforward. Christopher Sanchez has been superb. He's going to start game one. Aaron Nola becomes a massive X factor. He was solid on Sunday in his, I believe, second start off the IL. He's right-handed. The rest of that staff is lefty, right? So it'll probably go Sanchez, Nola, Ranger Suarez, Jesus Luzardo, with Taiwan Walker as that fifth man slash, you know, long relief. And what Nola is, I mean, this is the worst season of his career by far. He's been inconsistent. He has been hurt on the IL for the first time in many, many years. And what pitcher he shows up as in October will potentially determine how the Phillies season pans out. The one other series to talk about before we take a break is Mets over Braves. Another AL East showdown. Mets taking the first two, winning 12-7, winning 9-2. Braves try to blow it on Sunday, but they hang on to win 4-3. Nolan McClain, great on Friday, throwing 7 innings, striking out 7, allowing 2 earned runs. Mark Vientos is looking much, much better at the plate over the last couple of weeks. A lot more impact coming out of his bat. Frankie Montas, who is already something of a non-factor, having moved to the bullpen, he is out for the rest of the season with a UCL issue. Very interesting series coming up this week in New York with the Mets hosting the Phillies with a chance to crawl back into the NL race.
Yeah, I think, again, Nolan McClain continues to become more and more interesting and more important. I think seeing the Mets win a series on the road is nice to see because they have the worst road record of any playoff team. But, you know, you felt like you were going to maybe have a chance to sweep there. And they didn't, which is why we are still looking at standings that have them only a game and a half up on the Reds somehow, even though, and now, by the way, a worse run differential than the Reds too. So I don't know how we ended up there, but that is where we are. But at least they won the series. All right, let's take a break. When we return, we will go fast. We'll be right back on Baseball Barbercast.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbercast. Let's go fast.
Faster than fast, quicker than quick. I am lightning.
I feel the need.
It's turbo time.
The Astros take 3 out of 4 over the Orioles in Baltimore, spoiling the Samuel Basayo celebrations. They had them opportunity on Sunday, could not pull it off. 3 just brutal starts for the O's on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Brandon Young, Cade Povich, and Dean Kremer all bad. And of course, Trevor Rogers saves the day, avoiding the mop with an excellent start. We should just talk about Trevor Rogers on Wednesday. It has just been one of the most fascinating things of the season. He is, if you lower the innings limit to, I think, like 80 innings, he has the second best ERA in baseball, which is just outrageous. As for the Astros, Yordan Alvarez seems like he is going to be coming back this week, which will be a huge boost to them. He is a player who could really influence the playoff race and into the postseason.
Yeah, I mean, I hope so, just because I love Yordan. I mean, again, he was not, didn't look anything resembling himself before he has been on this lengthy injured list stint. So it will be nice to see him back in the lineup, start to feel like I'm actually watching the Astros again. But yes, and yeah, Trevor Rogers, my goodness. So let's go to Miami, where the Blue Jays take 2 out of 3 over the Marlins. Marlins avoid the sweep on Sunday because Yuri Perez is freaking awesome, and so is Jacob Marcy. But the Blue Jays do win this series, thanks in large part to a marvelous Blue Jays debut from one Shane Bieber.
Dude.
And very simple. That looked like Shane Bieber. That is a pitcher that I have, that we were watching at the end of last year, sorry, right before he went down last year, when it was basically as good as we've seen him since 2021. Sure, he's only throwing 92-93. But 92-93 is a big difference between 91-92. He was up to 94 in his rehab start. And if he's 93-94 with 2+ breaking balls, which have been plus for his whole career, right? The slider and curveball have both been nasty. With a changeup that looks as good as it's ever looked. I understand he's facing an extremely young lineup.
So new pitch, let's talk about that. Effectively. I mean, he's throwing the kick change, which has been one of the bigger pitches coming in this season. It's got a lot more drop to it at a higher velocity, right? And so it's harder for hitters to adjust. He was rolling that thing out against lefties and just kicking their ass. What I was most impressed about with Bieber is just how sharp the command was for a start back. Now, I mean, I understand that is what makes Shane Bieber Shane Bieber, right? He's not sitting at high 90s with outrageous stuff. You mentioned that they're plus breaking balls, but they're not like pitching ninja eyeballs popping out of your head, visually outrageous. Like, he is an elite pitcher because of his command, and it was unbelievable to watch. So, you know, on Sunday nights when I prep for the show, I go back and watch full starts of pitchers that I'm interested in. And so I watch Nolan McLean, who is very good, and then I watch Bieber. And like, not to throw shade on Nolan McLean, who's very good, the difference in command was just like a different sport. Like, Bieber's just like change up black outside, fastball in, you know, front hip and a lefty. It's just the way that he's able to pop that thing on the edge is really unique. And I cannot wait to see him start in the playoffs. Like, this, I don't think it could have been a more encouraging debut. The only run he allows was a fastball that got a little bit too much of the plate to Javier Sanoja, who pulled his hands in and cranked one. Give up 2 hits. Like, this is what they paid for. I was very impressed.
And that's also like, even a one moment like that, like, listen, he's not throwing 88, but that will be the challenge is it's still going to be harder for him, even if he is back up to 94, maybe even not able to get super optimistic 95. He's not necessarily going to be able to blow the fastball by anybody, let alone, I mean, if he can't get it by Javier Sanoja. You know, like, I know Sanoja's had a good season, but that will be the challenge, is kind of avoiding the long ball there, because there's just not that many pitchers that do it like Bieber right now. You know, you sort by the best pitchers in baseball. Most of them are throwing really hard, or they're extreme ground ball guys, right? The Logan Webbs, the Framber Valdez, the Christopher Sanchez of the world. I would say that, like, Yamamoto, when he's on, who also throws much harder than Bieber, but like, that's the kind of command that you're looking at, where it's not necessarily overwhelming stuff, but even he has, you know, a splitter and some pitches that are much more swing and miss. So I agree. It is a very specific, unique watch. I'd say that, like, maybe Sonny Gray is a good example of someone who, like, when he is cooking from a command standpoint with multiple pitches, he is dominating, even though he's not overwhelming. But there's not that many pitchers that are doing it like this at this level. And the fact that he looked like that already, and I know he's had a lot of rehab starts, so like, he's been building up to this. He's probably been ready for a few weeks now.
Though.
It's so exciting and just a huge deal for Toronto.
Yeah. And he's going to give up a tank in a playoff game, right? But because the rest of the package is so good, chances are there won't be anybody on base when that happens. Exactly. And that's like the Gerrit Cole thought, right? Like Cole, he's going to give up his tank. It's probably a solo shot and it's not going to hurt anybody. Let's go over to the Brewers. They took 2 out of 3 from the Giants, winning on Friday and Sunday.
No, they didn't. The other way around. Brewers did not win the series.
The Giants won the series?
Yeah.
See, this is a great
Did you turn it off when Trevor McGill had the lead on Sunday? Because they did not hold that.
I did. Did they lose that game?
Yeah.
See, I just assume now that the Brewers win. Quickly on the
please. Go ahead, Sunday, correct. Just make sure we say facts.
Wow. The Giants beat the Brewers? On Friday, when William Contreras hits a walk-off home run and the Brewers kind of stream out of the dugout to celebrate, they looked bored. Like it was an unbelievable game and an unbelievable moment. And not to say that they weren't excited, but it was just like they had done this 100 times already this season and they had seen wilder stuff than just a regular walk-off home run. So they just walk out of the dugout and they're all clapping and they're like, nice, so walk-off home run. Whereas if that had happened to the Rockies, it would have been fireworks. But yeah, you know, learning this now, I guess the Brewers lose the series. That's bad, yeah, right?
Logan Webb was fantastic on Saturday. And then, yeah, I mean, it was disappointing. They had Sunday was the Bob Uecker celebration of life. Everyone wearing the Uke jerseys. A lot of really cool moments in Milwaukee that day, for sure. That still, of course, hold up. But yeah, Trevor McGill just kind of coughed it up. Giants had a big rally against him in the. By the way, it's honestly a good contrast because coming off of Bieber, like McGill is just trying to throw it past you. Like, I know he's got a breaking ball, but he's up there. He is just trying to huck it past you at 101. And a lot of the times he can. But in this case, the Giants were on him, kind of rallied back, ended up winning 4-3 as Ryan Walker closes it out. So, yeah, shocking little series victory there for San Francisco. Brewers still have the best record in baseball comfortably, but little bit of a disappointing ending to obviously a special day in Milwaukee.
Joey Ortiz is hurt. Now, that might not sound like a big deal because he is not a good offensive player, but his ability to pick it at shortstop is really important to the way the Brewers play. Andrew Monasterio is going to fill in there now for a little bit until Ortiz is back. Just something to keep an eye on, right? Are there fewer ground balls converted to outs? How does that change the way that they do the interchangeable pieces stuff? Seems a little bit more important than I think it's getting credit for. D-backs taking 2 out of 3 over the Reds, who I'm disappointed in. The Reds, they avoid getting swept on Sunday. Congratulations. But like the Saturday game, Jordan, you get an opener, Jalen Beeks for the Diamondbacks. You get 4 scoreless from Nabil Chrismat and 4 runs and 1 earned from Jake Woodford.
Yeah, Jake Woodford.
Is that his name?
I assume that's the first save of his career. I didn't even know he was on the D-backs.
And the Reds
that
just...
That is troubling. Yeah.
Oh, man. They just... Yeah. They piss me off so much. Just... You're so close.
You can keep saying that. You can keep saying that, but they're game and a half back. You know, run differential looks good. Never been swept. I don't know. I obviously mostly agree with you. And by the way, Arizona just like randomly playing better. Zach Gallen suddenly looks great. Come on. Where was this, Snakes? Come on. But their
next
bullpen is
couple
like,
of weeks wow. for the Reds.
Yeah.
Dodgers, Cardinals, Blue Jays, Mets, yeah. Padres. Okay.
This is the thing. We'll know. Toughest schedule in the league. So good luck with that.
Tigers taking 2 out of 3 over the Royals. Royals avoiding the sweep on Sunday. Incredible post-game interview on Sunday from Vinny Pasquantino. Did you see this? Talking about
how they have
the Royals fantasy football draft on Sunday night. And so winning that Sunday game was enormous for them from a vibes perspective. Vinny, the commissioner of that league, wish him the best. He homered on Friday and again on Sunday. Tigers just kind of out-tigering the Royals, for lack of a better term here. The Royals not being able to win this series when Skubal was not going does not bode well for their playoff chances. They remain, I believe, 3 games out of a playoff spot in the American League. Rays taking 2 out of 3 over the Cardinals. This was a slightly weird series because there was an off day on Saturday as the Tampa Bay Buccaneers played a preseason game on Saturday. The Stein is next door to Raymond James Stadium, which is in my head. Good job, Jake. And so they couldn't play on Saturday. I'm fascinated to know what they did with their bizarre, rare Saturday off day. But the highlight from this was Carson Williams, top prospect for the Rays, we talked about on Friday, going 2 for 4 with his first career home run on Friday's game as the Rays win that one 10-6. And then the last series of the weekend, White Sox taking 2 out of 3 over the Twins, who have more or less phoned it in. They win the first game of this set on a Royce Lewis grand slam, 9-7. Colson Montgomery homering on Saturday and on Sunday, grand slam in game 2, another homer in game 3. And like, he's been legitimately good. And if the White Sox are going to be legitimately good anytime soon, they need Colson Montgomery to be a big part of that. That's incredibly encouraging on that front. As you mentioned earlier on, the Twins search for hashtag rock bottom. The number one overall pick is officially on. They, I believe, are still 12 games worse. The White Sox are 12 games worse than the Twins, so they have a lot of work to do to help those odds, but this stinker this weekend certainly helped. And then we got some news that the Field of Dreams game is going to be happening next year once again. Ooh, with the Twins against back. The Phillies. Mick Abel and Yoan Duran going toe-to-toe. That'll be very fun.
Can we call up Tait to hit some homers into the cornfields? That's probably a little aggressive, but Walker Jenkins, who was just promoted to AAA, I have a feeling he will be there, and that will be a sliver of hope and optimism for a Twins team that we'll see what this looks like next year. But they are going to be very bad for the rest of this year. Only 2 games better than the Pirates at this point. Yikes, Minnesota. All right, that's it. We talked about the weekend. The week ahead, not too many marquee series this week. We have, as you mentioned before, the Phillies at the Mets. We have Padres at Mariners. That is definitely quite juicy. Reds at Dodgers. Reds, show us something. Show us something. Maybe, kind of, possibly, probably not. We'll see. But yeah, Padres, Mariners, obviously be locked in on that one. And maybe the Mets can find some mojo against the Phillies, especially playing at home where they are way, way, way better. Anything else you're looking forward to this week before we say goodbye?
I'll be up there on Wednesday in New York for that game, the third one of that set, Phillies against the Mets. I'm excited to step back into the Big Apple and watch some ball up there. As a reminder, before we get out of here, you are now able to watch Baseball Barbacast on Yahoo Sports Network, the first ever streaming channel for Yahoo. Pretty amped about it. We've talked about it a lot. You could watch it on your TV, your television. It's available on leading fast channels, streaming live 24/7 on yahoosports.tv. Catch all the shows across our network. There are some good ones. I went on the daily Yahoo Sports podcast last week and had some fun talking about some of the more interesting storylines in ball. Do that. It helps the show, helps the network. We couldn't be more happy with things here at Yahoo. Thank you to TJ Brasu and Andrew Hartz for producing. Thank you to Jordan Schusterman for joining me. Thank you to the baseball players for playing the baseball. We will talk to you again on Wednesday. Goodbye.